The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujak, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
In the past few years, Americans' obsession with vampires seem to have no limits, whether it's the popular Twilight books and films or the True Blood TV series. Millions of people can't seem to get enough of the vampire story. So, with that in mind, and because we're just a few days away from Halloween, we're going to dedicate this edition of UWM Today to vampires and their place in learning. Joining us in the studio today is Megan Murphy Lee. She's a senior lecturer in Russian and Slavic studies at the university. And believe it or not, she's teaching a course this semester that has a heavy, heavy dose of vampires. Welcome. Good to have you with us, Megan.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Sure. So tell us about this course. What the heck are we talking about vampires for?
Well, it's a course. The main focus is Slavic folklore. So the students read and learn about the life of the Slavic peasant, you know, centuries ago, and their religion, their pagan faith, and how they converted into Christianity, and how their lives were influenced by their religion and by their life. So their farming lifestyle influenced their belief system. So we talk a lot about the spirits and the gods that they believed in, and they had a strong belief in the separation between the body and the spirit or the soul. And so that leads into stories about the undead and vampires. So we begin just talking about the Slavic peasants' belief in the undead and the life after death. And then we read folk tales about vampires. But then we also bridge into the literary vampires. So we read Bram Stoker's Dracula, and we also read other short stories, Western and Slavic in origins, to show how the vampire has developed from a belief in vampires from centuries ago to the modern Twilight or True Blood vampire.
So the students in the class, are they taking the class because they know you're going to be talking about vampires and they are fans of the TV show, or are they surprised when they walk into the class and discover that this story about folklore in those countries far away includes something that might be kind of fun to talk about?
Well, I think it's about half and half. We have half of the students are really interested in folklore. And the problem with the study of folklore is it's not in one department. So students have to go to the anthropology department, to the history department, to the language department to learn about folklore. So some people are really interested in folklore and some are creative writers and write their own folklore. Folk tales and whatnot. And then some of them are interested in vampires. I have a lot of students that have read more than I have about vampires. One of the girls in my student in my class has been reading about vampires since she was 12. So she says she's read everything that she could find in English about vampires. So some of them are really into that. We do have some students that are Russian majors that want to learn about Slavic folklore because understanding the folklore of a people helps you understand their culture and just their belief systems better.
And sort of what shaped or formed them, right?
Right, exactly. Because a lot of these beliefs, especially the beliefs in the body and the spirit, are alive even to this day, that they part of the Russian Orthodox belief system is that when a person dies, their soul departs their body, and for 40 days, they kind of are loose in the world before they go either to heaven or hell. So the idea of the body and spirit being two separate entities is still a part of their belief system today. And there probably are people that still believe in vampires. I know that I had a student from Romania, and her grandmother still strongly believed in vampires and had garlic around her door frames in Romania. So it still is a part of some people's belief system to this day.
Okay, I got to ask, what about your students? I mean, the girl who started reading at the age of 12 and has consumed everything. Do you ever come across students who do believe, who think vampires maybe are real?
Well, There have been a few. I never actually asked them outright. And I do always tell them at the beginning that I myself do not believe that vampires exist, but they are fascinating to read and study. But some of the students that I've had in the past, because I've taught this at University of Arizona and at Bates College as well, some of them do seem to perhaps believe in vampires and the supernatural. So I try to steer away from that type of conversation, but I think some of them do. And I've had a couple of them students in the past that I worry might actually believe they are vampires. But that's obviously very rare. Most of them are just like Twilight and True Blood. And
yeah, you don't want to be hanging around the classroom after class is over with those students.
Well, exactly. Especially we have class during the day for a reason. You know.
Good point. And who knows? I mean, some of these folks, having watched the TV series or see the films, might think that they might meet someone as cute as the actors or the actresses that star in those movies.
Right. Well, and that's a modern interpretation of the vampire. Obviously, in the folklore, they might have been attractive because they were rich or wealth, you know, or from the upper class, but they usually did not look like the, you know, people from True Blood and from the Vampire Diaries and whatnot. So that's kind of a new modern interpretation of the vampire, having them be so attractive.
If you can, take us back a little bit and tell us when this whole notion of vampires was first around. Can you track back to a date or a period where people first began talking about this?
Well, it's hard, like you said earlier, it's hard to trace back the origins of folklore, since a lot of folk tales are oral in nature and weren't written down probably till the 18th or 19th century. But the belief in vampires and undead creatures is back as long as there have been stories that they've had other creatures besides vampires. The actual term vampire, they trace it. Many people believe that the word itself is of Slavic origin, and you see it first in about the 1400s. But the belief in the afterlife and undead creatures dates back much further than that. But then the actual written tales about vampires, like that weren't folk tales, started. Many people believe it's Lord Byron was one of the first that wrote a tale about vampires.
That really organized it into a narrative that gave it some richness or some fuller context than just this image of a blood-sucking being.
Right. Well, I mean, and he switched it instead of, because the folktale about vampire was used as a warning for young children, mostly young girls, not to go out at night by themselves and beware of strangers and how to behave a certain way. Because that's what folktales normally did, was kind of an education for the young people.
So we could blame the parents for coming up with this
notion.
Well,
exactly. Right? Well, usually grandparents. Like grandmothers would often tell these. And I think that, and even to this day, you know, grandmothers tell their grandchildren, you know, you better be careful, or, you know, the tooth fairy won't give you your quarter or whatever it is nowadays. You know, the older generation always kind of uses stories and these mythical creatures to teach children how to behave a certain way. But what the literary vampire did was kind of change it to be purely entertainment. You know, and so there isn't as much of a moral to these tales. It's just entertaining. It's a good escape for readers. And that's why I think it's so popular today, is because, you know, it's difficult for young people nowadays, and it's nice to escape to a whole nother world with these magical creatures that are very attractive and, you know, interact with human young girls or young boys, you know. And so I think it helps them kind of escape to another world.
Yeah. You know, anyone who's traveled in those countries, and I've been fortunate enough to walking around at night, you do get a sense in some of those Slavic countries that someone's over your shoulder. I don't know, maybe because you read the stories that of Transylvania and who's lurking around the corner. So when you introduce this as a vehicle for learning in your classroom, how long does it take for your students to get excited about the subject matter itself? If you're teaching, you know, Slavic language or Slavic literature, how long is this a good hook for them to say, gee, I want to learn more, or maybe I'd like to travel there?
Well, it depends on the student, but my philosophy is that you just need to figure out a way to present the material that's interesting to the students, because I love Russian and Russian culture and folklore so much that I think that if you just get the students in the classroom and get them maybe to start talking about vampires or something that's interesting to them, that they'll be willing to, you know, take more classes. So I think of this as like a gateway course. And I've already had one student who took my vampire class last semester, who is now in my Russian 101 class and is actually declared a Russian major after this. So although it's rare, it kind of piques their interest because we don't just talk about vampires, of course. They learn a lot about, you know, the Slavic culture and music and literature. And I even teach them Russian words, too, now and again, you know, to kind of give them an overall view of, you know, Slavic culture.
In terms of studying the culture, how important is it for these students to also try to learn the language? You mentioned you introduced a couple of words. Is there a deeper connection, a deeper understanding of that culture when you mix language into the equation?
Oh, I think there is. But the way that I do have some students that know Russian in my class, and I do think that they get a little bit more out of it than the ones that don't. But the way that I think about it is that if they don't have any Russian background and they take this folklore class, it might interest them into taking the language. But I do think that it's vital to understanding the people and the culture to understand the language as well, because the way that a language is structured tells you a lot about the people and what's important to them.
What attracted you to the study of the Slavic culture?
Well, I actually studied
Russian and Slavic,
yeah,
I should say.
My undergraduate degree was from Illinois Wesleyan University in Bloomington. And I started off as an economics major, and I needed a foreign language course. And this was in 1989. So I decided to take Russian, partially because it was in the news every day, talking about the Soviet Union. And that was during the period of Glasnost and Perestroika with Gorbachev and all the changes. And so it was really in the news every day. And so I decided to take Russian, even though I was an economics major. And I just fell in love with it. And it was great because I was watching history unfold right before my eyes. So I took Russian history courses.
But you're not Russian yourself.
No, I'm not. I'm actually, I'm from Chicago. And I don't have any, I'm part Slovak, but I have no Russian roots at all. Okay. So,
well, fellow Slovak, I'm 100% Slovak.
Really?
So there must be a book that you could introduce about the Slovaks, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, there are Slovaks play a prominent role actually in Bram Stoker's Dracula, and we do talk about them.
Yeah, and a very active community of Slovaks here in the Metro Milwaukee area. Yeah. But we digress. So when students get excited about this, and they say, you know, this is kind of fun, kind of a connection. Mm-hmm. Do you see them really trying to get deeper into the culture itself in terms of the economy, in terms of, you know, how these societies are structured today versus what happened 200 or 300 years ago?
Well, and I think they do. And I think it depends on what the student is interested in before they begin the course, because I have the one girl in my class who has been studying since she was 12, she is a creative writer. And so she uses this information to help write better stories. But I've had students that were business majors, and that what they do then is their interest in Russian then branches off into business, or they learn about Russian economics or try to take Russian in order to, you know, do business in Russia or whatnot. So I think that this is kind of a good way to kind of light the fire of interest with these students, and they can take it in all different ways. I have quite a few global studies majors in my class, anthropology majors, even a couple classics majors that are just taking it for various reasons. You know, some love folklore, some are interested in Russian. You know,
and living in the world we do, where it's flat, and where a lot of the students today may find themselves living and working in a country far away from the U.S. in this global economy that we have, the quicker we get them students connected to this notion that there are people doing amazing things in other parts of the world, that the better off we're training students for that world. Right.
Well, and it's also good for them to understand that different cultures approach things differently. and that they're, a lot of times their mindset and their belief system is different than ours, and that it's not bad, it's just different, and that the reason why they have these different belief systems might be the way that they, their ancestors lived and what they did for a living, you know. Or, but what's really I find interesting is a lot of my students, when we talk about the pagan faith of the Slavs, they've taken like Greek mythology or Roman mythology, and they notice that there are quite a few similarities, because, and I try to tell them that because your religious faith has a lot to do with your lifestyle and how you live and what you find important, it makes sense, because they, you know, back then in Greece, they were farmers too. They were peasants, just like the Slavs were peasants, a little different, but they had nature-based religion. So it's kind of interesting for them to see that although there are some differences, people, you know, farmers and peasants lived
people
basically the same life. Yeah. You know, they had the same thing. They had families. They lived in, you know, houses and had farm animals and whatnot. Yeah.
You're listening to UWM Today on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack. Joining us in the studio, not a vampire, but a woman who uses vampires, at least the theme of them, in some of her teaching. Megan Murphy-Lee is teaching Russian Slavic studies at the university. And we're talking, because it is Halloween, of course, we've got to talk about vampires. It's part of the way to hook a young student, but also talking about this whole notion of folklore. And I'd like to spend a little time now going beyond vampires, mm-hmm. and just think about other ways in which folklore has influenced perhaps our lives in ways that we might not have noticed. How deep is the practice or the study of folklore here in America?
I think that the study of folklore has been going on for centuries now, but a lot of times people don't think of it as folklore, but it's a part of our everyday life. Even such things as, you know, Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, the Tooth Fairy, stories of Paul Bunyan, that's all part of American and Western folklore. And that folklore...
You mean the blue ox isn't real?
Yeah. Yes. And it all teaches...
She popped my bubble.
I know. Sorry about that. It teaches us lessons, or teaches young people lessons, you know. So you have to behave well, or Santa Claus won't give you any presents, or, you know, that you have to be a good student, or maybe if you put your tooth in the little pillow, the tooth fairy won't come. And so they... adults use these folkloric characters to kind of show children how to behave and kind of give them an incentive to behave properly. And, of course, back in the Slavic world, the vampire is obviously used as a detriment. You should need to behave, stay away from rich strangers, don't go out at night, or you will come across a vampire.
So are there certain formulas for these folklore stories that repeat themselves with the local flavor or local flair?
Exactly, yeah. And there's actually Vladimir Prop is a scholar, folklorist, who in the 20s wrote a book about the morphology of folklore. And it's really about the folktale. And we read that in class. And he came up with a system of how to organize folk tales. And that most folk tales start a certain way, have certain types of heroes, and have certain types of characters, and that it's best to organize folklore according to these structures, because then you can see the similarities, because like a Swedish folktale and a Russian folktale really aren't very different if you get past the names of the characters and the type of talking animals or magical objects. When you look at the functions of these tales, they basically are very similar. And if you look at these and break them down that way, you can see the similarities in the values of the different cultures.
So is there always a good and an evil in the story? Is it always built around some sort of morality tale?
Well, usually in most, according to Prop, in most fairy tales he focused on, there is a hero. There are different types of heroes, of course, and there is a villain. And then the hero goes on some sort of quest. Either he's forced on a quest, or he or she decides to go on the quest on his or own decision. You know, they decide to save the day, or they're forced to save the day. And then they must go and request some sort of magical object from, usually it's an old grandmother or an old lady that they meet on the way. And that one, that person is the donor and gives the hero must do some sort of task in order to get the magical object. And then they use a magical object in order to, you know, save the princess or save the sister or whomever. And then it usually ends in, if it's an unmarried person, it usually ends in the hero or heroine marrying and having a son, of course, usually. Or if the person is married, they're reunited with their family because they went to save someone in their family and they're all reunited at the end. And so it depends on how the tale is structured, what the actual moral of the tale. But most folk and fairy tales do have a moral or a, you know, teaching point at the end.
Is it surprising that as educated as we are today, as sophisticated in terms of our use of technology, that we as parents ourselves continue to teach or use these fairy tales to teach morality?
Well, I mean, I think that it really speaks to young children because oftentimes they're structured in a very easy way for them to understand. They're repetitive. They have interesting characters. They have witches and werewolves and vampires and all these neat villains. And then it always has a happy ending. So I think that children and young people are attracted to these kind of tales, especially when they're really small. And so the parents can kind of use this tale to kind of teach the lesson. I mean, I think there are a lot of modern folk tales, too. A lot of children's books that teach modern lessons as well.
Berenstain Bears.
Right. You know? Yeah, exactly. And and so they're kind of, each generation has their own version of it. But I mean, a lot of times people go back to, you know, grim fairy tales.
Which, by the way, can be very violent.
Well, yes. And I think that a lot of parents nowadays use the kind of the sanitized version. But a lot of these folk tales are quite scary and violent. And a lot of times they're scaring the children into behaving a certain way. I think nowadays we don't tend to do that as much, especially with small children. But back, you know, a few hundred years ago, these tales were to scare these kids into behaving properly.
Because back then, you could make one wrong move and cost you your life.
Well, exactly. And they have, like, in Slavic folklore, there's these water spirits that are active right as the ice are breaking up in the fall. I mean, in the spring, sorry. And then, so these water spirits can grab you and drown you in the water if you're not careful. And what it's supposed to do is so the children do not go near the ice when the ice is breaking up in the spring, because that's the most dangerous time to be on the water. So they scare these kids to death because they're like, oh, well, we can't go near the water because this evil water spirit will grab up, you know, and take us into the water and kill us.
But in fact, the great-great-great-grandparent who came up with that idea said, I may be scaring them to death, but they won't really die because they're going to stay away.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So all these spirits and gods have a different function and teach children and young people. Because, I mean, even adults would probably stay away from the water, you know, at that time of year anyway,
yeah.
Because they've learned their whole life about these horrible water spirits. There's usually one person that sees the spirit, probably when they're drinking, you know, and they're out in the water and like, oh, my goodness, I saw this evil water spirit. And then they tell the whole village. And so it kind of revives the story once again.
Well, having tried some of the Slivovitz that is produced in those countries,
well, exactly.
It's no wonder that you may see some spirits consuming
exactly.
The spirits.
Right. And so it could just be that you see something strange in the night and so you believe that it is this vampire or this mora, which is another undead spirit that they have. So yeah, it kind of reinforces the whole folklore. And so the whole village then once again believes and say, oh, remember, Yvonne over there, he saw that 3 years ago.
And boy,
like
that sticks with you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Disney, of course, is probably a great example of how a big American industry has made billions of dollars in profit by incorporating those folklore tales mm-hmm. Into their business practices.
Right. And they've kind of fit it into contemporary American culture, too, because they've adjusted these folk tales to fit the kind of sensibilities of contemporary America. So it's a lot, I think of it kind of more sanitized because there's not as much violence and not as many people die in the tales and, you know, that the happy ending comes much easier. But in a lot of these folk tales, you know, half the family has to die before the hero or heroine saves the day.
Yeah, and of course, it is sanitized, and, mm-hmm. you know, it sort of glosses over the fact that to get to the happy ending, there is a lot of tragedy that occurs. I remember when my daughter was young and we were reading these fairy tales, I'll never forget, there was this sort of dawning on her, maybe 7, 8 or so, where I remember vividly her saying, "Dad, this is really gross. This is mm-hmm. really, really bad." I was reading it for entertainment and thought she would find entertainment. She saw the gruesomeness here mm-hmm. and was looking at me like, "What kind of a parent are you? What are you reading this to me for?"
Right. Well, it's also teaching them, too, that violence and that is a part of life and that struggle, like that the hero always must struggle before he or she attains his or her goal. And so it kind of teaches children also that they have to strive and struggle in order to get what they want, that it never comes easy for these heroes, at least the non-Disney heroes. You know, they always must struggle and people in they love sometimes die or, you know, they get hurt for some reason or another, but they prevail in the end if they work hard and persist and are valiant and brave and all those characteristics that a hero has.
If you had a crystal ball and looked forward 100 years, would it be your prediction people are still going to be telling folk stories and maybe celebrating vampires?
Oh, yeah, I think so. And because everyone thinks about the current vampire craze, but this is not the first one. I mean, there was a vampire craze in the 1500s and there was one and, you know, it's every maybe 50 years or so. I mean, in the, you know, 1920s and 30s, there was huge vampire craze. There's a large craze right when Bram Stoker's novel Dracula came out in 1896.
Well, and all the movies, the mm-hmm. both silent movies
yeah.
and then the early movies in the 30s that
right,
Boris Karloff.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Yeah, the, because one of the first horror movies ever created was Nosferatu, a German silent movie about, you know, which was an adaptation of Dracula. So, I mean, I think that my theory on this is that a lot of times when we're going through a rough time, like in the 20s and 30s, it was very unstable economically. In the 70s, vampires were also really popular, thanks to Anne Rice. And that was also a very turbulent time.
Set down in New Orleans?
Mm-hmm, yes, exactly. Yeah. So I think that when there is a time of instability or economic crisis, that people turn to things like vampires and the supernatural kind of as an escape. So I think that this is not the last vampire craze. And I had a friend in the department that joked with me and said, "Oh, Megan, you know, in just a couple years, no one's going to want to take this class." And I pointed out to him that there was a professor at University of Virginia. His name was Jan Prokofsky, and he taught a Slavic vampire course for 40 years at UVA. And it never went out of style, and his class was always full. And he was kind of like the father of the Slavic study of the Slavic vampire. So I don't think it'll ever go away because there's always people that want to escape and that are interested in the supernatural.
Well, you are so enthusiastic and you've done such a wonderful job getting us excited. We hope you're teaching this course 40 years from now.
Well, I hope so too.
And wish you the very, very best.
Well, thank you so much.
Megan Murphy-Lee, Senior Lecturer in Russian Slavic Studies, our guest on this edition of UWM Today as we talk about folklore and vampires and Halloween is right around the corner, so we have to wish you a happy Halloween. Take care, everybody. Have a great week. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet the faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.